this shows you a further assessment of what's going on with vehicular injury costs. The red are occupant injuries. But the combination of green, purple, yellow from ages 4 to 12 is larger than the red, and that's pedestrian injury, pedal cycle, motor vehicle, and motor vehicle non-cycle. You can see that no motor vehicle pedal cycle injuries are a very important piece of the motor vehicle risk, or the vehicular risk, I should say, from ages 4 to 12. This slide shows you driver age in crashes where a teen passenger was injured. And you can see 60% of them, it's another teen driving, and another 16%, an older sibling or other young adult driving. So this is a very constrained group. In terms of annual poisoning costs, you can see that the risks 0 to 4 are big unintentional poisoning costs for children. 15 to 19, there are big costs for poisoning caused by suicidal acts. And costs help us see how to assess those risks. Here's another aspect. 90% of costs ages 0 to 4 of injury are unintentional injury. When we go to 5 to 9, suddenly rape and sexual assault is 26% of the cost. That pattern continues at age 10 to 14. By age 15 to 19, assault suddenly becomes important and suicide important as well. Surprisingly, we don't talk much about rape and sexual assault in this country, but it's a big piece of our child injury costs. In terms of advocacy, I thought I'd use underage drinking as an example. The costs of underage drinking in 2007 were $65 billion. The bulk of that came from illegal acts, violence, motor vehicle crashes, impaired driving, and property crime are by far the bulk of that cost. But what psychologists tell us is that you don't know the difference between $6 billion and $65 billion. They're both bigger than you have any feel for. So how can we make that big number comprehensible? One way to do that is use a yardstick. The costs of underage drinking are roughly equal to the combined budgets of the U.S. Departments of Justice and Education. All the money we spend on the police, all the money we spend on the courts, all the money we spend on the schools at the federal level, the costs of underage drinking. Another thing to do is to divide by a sensible exposure measure. The costs are $5,000 per underage drinker. They're about $2,300 per youth ages 14 to 20. My favorite, they're $3.30 per illegal drink. And every kid's drink, on average, carries a tangible cost in work loss and out-of-pocket costs for medical spending and criminal justice of $1.10. By comparison, that drink only costs $1.20. Miller Brewing Company says there's only 60 cents in profit on that drink. We only collect 10 cents in taxes on that drink. Somehow we need to recover more of the public cost and get this under control. It lets me make a point because of the way I've structured it. Another way to do it is with a conformance comparison. This is something that will rapidly get the attention of an Ohio legislator. The costs per youth of underage drinking in Ohio are higher by far than in any of its neighboring states. And this shows you that in the U.S. generally, the costs of underage drinking are highest in sort of the Midwestern states, straight up and down from north to south, and parts of the south. Here's another performance comparison. The gunshot costs per resident are almost 2.5 times as high in the United States as they are in Canada. Does that mean that Canadians are less violent? No, it means they have less guns. The gunshot costs per gun are actually higher in Canada. Broad priority setting. Injury is second only to respiratory conditions as a cost of childhood medical spending. And the third here is mental conditions. That tells us something about where our funds for childhood prevention should be going. Resource allocation. The largest risks among consumer products among kids under age 5 are stairs or steps, beds, not cribs, floors, tables, sofas and high chairs, and chairs. Not quite what we might have expected. By ages 5 to 9, it's bicycles and playground equipment and still beds, doors, and stairs. And ages 10 to 14 and 15 to 19, bicycles, participatory sports, and skating still sticks in here. And stairs and steps still stick in here. Those falls don't go away as kids get older. That tells us a lot about where our priorities for injury prevention in different age groups should be. Program evaluation is another use of costs. A poison control center call currently costs about $43. It saves $320 in medical care alone. Very nice intervention. A regional trauma care system raises the initial care cost by about $1,850 in admission. But by the time the patient finishes all their medical treatment, it's saved $2,250. So there's a net saving just in medical care costs with regionalized trauma care. And a message for our insurers. The average child seat costs about $50. It saves $330 in insurance and tax payments. Very powerful statement. As we look at costs, they're estimated from a perspective. Most of the costs I've shown you are from society's perspective, but I could have looked at costs and savings to government or insurers or employers. And what we use are what are called incidence-based costs. Those are the lifetime consequences of the injuries in 1 year, and that's useful for measuring the savings from prevention. Because some of those costs will occur in future years, and you could put the money in the bank now to pay them. We discount the cost back to how much we'd have to put in the bank today to pay them. And the choice of discount rate is critical. $1 million in 20 years is worth only about $600,000 at a 2.5% discount rate. A 7% discount rate is worth about $300,000. Based on the panel on cost effectiveness in health and medicine, we're using a 2.5% to 3% discount rate in all of our work that I'll show you today. And it's worth reminding you what the cost categories are that fall into the burden of injuries. They're what are called economic costs, the medical costs, the mental health care costs, other resource or tangible costs ranging from emergency services to victim services, legal, court, jail, insurance administration, property damage, what economists call productivity, and I think in simpler English is work loss, both wage work loss and household work loss, and then less tangible is quality of life loss. The quality of life loss is about 65% of the total costs. About a quarter of the total cost is the work loss, and the medical costs are about 10%. Those other resource costs are negligible, except in the case of violence. So, let's talk about whether your money is working hard enough for you. It's useful to think of intervention as a three-legged stool. There's prevention of what we can. There's reducing the harm of what we can't prevent. And there's treating what still occurs. The fact sheet set that we've just released, and I'll give you an email address for it later, and almost all the numbers that I'm going to show you from now on are in that fact sheet set, contains 159 interventions. Most of those are either motor vehicle, including impaired driving, violence, other injury, just a broad category. And actually, something looks wrong with my other injury count there. It is wrong. The other injury should say 14 there. I'm sorry. The substance abuse is 38. I changed the wrong line. So other injury, substance abuse, and violence, substance abuse, and motor vehicle, including impaired driver, are the three areas where we have the most. It's split about equally between youth, adults, and combined youth and adult problems. Most of the data in these fact sheets come from U.S. and some international published, non-published studies from 1987 through 2010, and we search for those. We do a lot using the injury literature search that David Lawrence sends out, monitoring that. We also use Medline, internet searches, bibliographic review, contact with federal agencies, safety net, that's what it's called. And we excluded analyses of occupational air, rail, and water transport safety programs when we did the review. We used the cost from society's viewpoint. Everything I'll show you is in $2009. Savings from demonstration programs are reduced by 25% because we assume that scale up from a randomized trial will probably not be as successful as the trial is initially because it's in replication. We corrected serious study flaws that existed or else we left out the study. We subjectively graded the rigor of the program cost and effectiveness estimates in some of our publications. And we excluded studies that looked at the reductions in fatalities but didn't look at what happened to non-fatal injuries unless there was other data telling us that. You'll find on the fact sheets that we give a cost per unit. That's the cost of the intervention for a single individual. We give the total cost, the total benefits per unit. That's the amount that the intervention saves by preventing injuries and other problems from that one unit. And I encourage you to calculate, because we couldn't put all the numbers on the spreadsheet or we've overwhelmed people. But when you're using a specific benefit cost ratio, calculate the aggregate benefit per unit. That's the total benefits minus the cost. That's the net savings that you get from that. We give you a benefit cost ratio, that's the savings from preventing the injuries divided by the cost of the intervention. And we talk about cost effectiveness, meaning the benefit cost ratio is greater than one, or the return on investment in the intervention exceeds the amount that was invested. We also give in the fact sheets what's called a cost per quality adjusted life year. We compute that by taking the cost of the intervention, subtracting the medical and other resource cost savings, and then dividing by the number of quality-adjusted life years saved. A quality-adjusted life year is a health outcome measure that assigns a value of 1 to a year of perfect health and 0 to death. They're routinely used in clinical trials, and the quality measure captures the work loss and quality of life savings. If we say something is cost-saving, if the medical costs and other resource savings alone exceed the cost of the intervention, meaning that the cost per quality is less than zero. We recommend generally that you not adopt interventions with a benefit cost ratio less than 2 or a cost per quality adjusted life year greater than $50,000 unless there's some very specific reason for that and you've thought it through very carefully. If there are competing interventions, they're probably wiser choices. Nevertheless, there are some times where you've got the money, that's the only intervention that addresses some unique component of the injury problem, and it can be worthwhile. And one of the reasons we recommend being careful there is because there's variance around effectiveness. So you want some wiggle room in case your trial, your implementation, doesn't prove to be quite as effective as the average. Another point I want to make is that when we cost laws, we cost the personal freedom lost from the law and the discomfort. So if we cost a motorcycle helmet law, we take account of the discomfort and inconvenience that the motorcyclists suffer when they're forced to wear a motorcycle helmet. That means that if we looked from government's perspective, the costs of implementing those laws would be much lower and the benefit cost ratios would be higher. I wanted to note some of the new interventions that we've added in updating the fact sheets. There are about 35, six new interventions Some of them that I'm excited about are a 20-bed domestic violence shelter, speed and red light cameras, sprinklers in new homes, CPSC's, the Consumer Product Safety Commission's mattress flammability standard, their baby walker redesign standard, which is greatly cutting falls downstairs from in baby walkers. And one that's a little bit tricky is impact-absorbing playground surfacing. The benefit-cost ratio here would be much higher, except for that it appears that a lot of the savings from impact-absorbing surfacing are cashed out. The kids take more risks when the surfaces are more convenient. The parents are a little less diligent in supervising when the surfaces are more forgiving. And so what happens is that you see much less reduction in injury than you'd expect. Somebody has asked me to give an example of an intervention with a below benefit cost ratio, but it addresses a unique component of an injury problem. Let me give you an example without saying that it's a low benefit cost ratio. Suppose that there were 5 interventions out there that all addressed injuries on bicycles, but some of them, here's a much better example. Consider that you've got a bunch of programs out there that are school-based substance abuse prevention programs. Only one of them has been shown to work in Native America, and you've got a Native American population. Even if it's a low benefit cost ratio, maybe you're not willing to take the risk that the other ones will be culturally acceptable. I've also been asked how I put a cost on the loss of freedom. I'll give you some examples of that a little later on. But what we often do is look at the savings to the individuals from, say, wearing a motorcycle helmet. And they chose not to wear it. So clearly, the losses to them of not wearing that helmet, of wearing that helmet in terms of loss of freedom and discomfort or whatever, were at least as large as the savings that they would have experienced in injury costs by wearing that helmet. So the only savings that we account for a motorcycle helmet are savings to people other than the helmet wearer and savings that the helmet wearer didn't perceive because they underperceived their risk. Let me talk about violence interventions now. The most effective violence interventions fall into categories, and they're non-offender violence prevention. And some of the most effective interventions there seem to be intensive home visitation to firstborn children in low-income families. One downside of these is it takes a long time to recover these costs. They're eventually recovered, more than recovered, but they're not recovered in the first year or two. It's a long-term investment. But it does reduce violence among youth. It does reduce other social problems and improves other aspects of the youth's lives, things like pregnancy outcomes, learning in school, parental employment. But it takes a long time to recover these costs. Violence, as we turn to interventions that are not over that long-term investment, it's really important to remember that violence is part of a problem complex. Among adults, about half of violence involves alcohol and drugs, about 14% of it both alcohol and drugs. If we look at kids, 70% involves alcohol and drugs. More than 40% involves both alcohol and drugs. So the same kids are drinking, drugging, violent. It turns out they're also smoking. They're also having risky sex. They also have eating disorders. They're also suicidal. It's all the same kids that these concentrate in. So as we look at juvenile violence interventions, we want to consider whether the interventions just affect violence or whether they also affect other kinds of impacts. And the other kinds of impacts here that we look at as they're also affecting are generally not measured in the evaluations. We've looked at treatment, foster care, multisystemic therapy, functional family therapy, said they're wonderful because of the outcomes they give us on violence. They probably reduced a lot of other problems among children and families that we didn't even measure. If we get to aggression replacement training, we're only affecting the violence. And we get to things like adolescent diversion or intensive probation supervision, we're largely just making it cheaper to supervise offenders. We're not preventing future offenses very well. Things like boot camp and scared straight largely don't work. What we found with scared straight is that among juveniles with problems, it gave them a role model among the offender community. Somebody's asked me what I mean by a long time with respect to some of the home visitation programs. And it can take at least 5 to 6 years to recover the costs on those, even to just single recovery, sometimes as much as 10 years. They're not quick recovery periods, though the values I showed you are present values, and usually it's about a 5-year recovery period. When we get to adult violence measures, moral recognition therapy, again, helps deal with the broader problems and is a very strong measure. Drug courts are strong, and helping people get jobs at release from prison is a very powerful measure. We turn now to specifically child injury prevention issues. A bicycle helmet for kids. It saves insurers about $41, only costs $10 to $15. You'll find the societal savings in the fact sheet set. A child seat, very good return on investment. Reducing misuse of child seats. It's very cheap to do that. We know lots of 70% or more of seats are fairly badly misused. We can take the effectiveness of a seat up from about 50% to at least 60 or 70% by reducing misuse. And that turns out to be very effective as we look back at how effective seats were before and after we started misuse reduction campaigns. Booster seats are also very effective injury prevention and very inexpensive injury prevention. Smoke alarms are another useful thing. You'll find this is a new estimate from the old one on smoke alarms because we now put many more alarms into a house than we used to on average. And we've taken account of that in the new benefit cost ratio. The injury prevention program for the American Academy of Pediatrics. It costs $11 a visit. It only saves $8 in medical spending. But that means we only spend about $3 to create $90 worth of good health. And that's a cheap way to create good health for our kids. Don't drink and draw signs. One thing that we need to think about as we deal with programs and as we get to something like drunk driving, where there are a lot of things that address drunk driving issues, is that generally, with some rare exceptions like child seats and booster seats and bicycle helmets, no one intervention will reduce most problems by more than 10 to 15%. So we need a package of complementary interventions when we can put one together. And as we think about drunk driving and how do we structure that package, 60% of drunk driving deaths are just people who occasionally take a drink. 10% are caused by hardcore recidivist drunk drivers, 18% by underage drinkers, 7% are motorcyclist drunk. And so we can address interventions that go to these different groups. We can address interventions that go to all drivers, things like enforcing laws against serving intoxicated patrons and server training. And those, you'll notice, will also prevent other alcohol-involved problems, things like administrative license revocation, intensive breath testing. and possibly the 0.08 maximum driver blood alcohol concentration. We don't know whether that one also causes people to drink less, whether it causes them to switch to drink in their home rather than the bar, which might reduce barroom brawls, but it might increase domestic violence. We don't know about that. We've never evaluated some of those effects. We get to youth, zero tolerance for youth, graduated licensing with a midnight curfew, the 21 minimum drinking age. These all, even though they've only been evaluated in terms of the first two, in terms of their effects on drunk driving, they're going to have a lot of other effects on kids. Midnight driving curfew, are we going to have less risky sex, less drug use, less total drunkenness? Probably. But we haven't measured that. Another, was it a drunk driving crash that I was amused by? When we get to recidivist drunk drivers, probably the best of the interventions is ignition interlocks and possibly house arrest, though it's expensive. Auto impoundment also works reasonably well. And then we can take those laws, passing laws, to do things like require child seats and close child seat gaps, require booster seats, primary belts, motorcycle helmets. These all reduce drunk driving deaths because people who get hit by drunk drivers are less vulnerable, and drunk drivers themselves may be less vulnerable. And then we have broader measures like regional trauma systems, brief alcohol interventions, alcohol taxes that are also things that are very much things that we can reduce drunk driving at the same time as other things. There are a lot of interventions that address substance abuse. And I want to talk about those a little because you'll recall that an awful lot of the consequences of substance abuse are injury. They're drunk driving, they're other injuries, they're violence. If we think about prevention, all prevention, not just impaired driving prevention, not just alcohol prevention, has three components. There's universal or environmental prevention, changing things so that everybody is protected and they don't have to do anything themselves. There's selective or educational prevention, where we go in and we talk to people at risk and help them to understand their risks and motivate them to do something about those risks. And there are indicated or behavioral prevention for people who already have problems. And indicated or behavioral prevention, I don't have benefit cost ratios for. The reason is that the typical model in substance abuse with people who already have a problem is to get them into case managed care. The case manager directs them to various services that help to protect them. And the randomized trials, we never track the uptake of those services and how long they stay in them in either the treatment group or the control group. So we don't really know what those models cost, even though we know how effective they are. These are some of the school-based programs. And if you look at the column here on the cost per kid of these programs, you'll see that they range from $140 all the way up to almost $500. This is the percentage reduction in marijuana use and then alcohol use that results from these programs. And you can see that the best of them are reducing alcohol marijuana use by about 6 to 7%. Keeping It Real does even better than that on alcohol use. These programs are all on the National Register of Effective Prevention Programs. But look at All-Stars here and compare it to Project Alert. Why would anyone take for $30 and lose 2% effectiveness against marijuana, 7% effectiveness against alcohol, and the T here means it's effective against tobacco, but I didn't want to overwhelm you by showing you T's all over the map. So some of these programs are just dominated out. The Project Star, $490, it really doesn't do any more than these. Perhaps if your biggest problem was marijuana and other drugs, and you had very little problem with alcohol, you might want to choose your problem because that's where your local problem is. So you might go there. Now, keep in mind this price range of about under $200 and 7% or so reductions. As we now look at family and community-based programs, the best of these programs is the Family Strengthening Program here. And it runs $1,100 a kid. But it also reduces marijuana use by 15%. It reduces alcohol use by 18%. It's a more powerful intervention. If you can afford it, it does some wonderful things. There's also another difference here. The Family Strengthening Program is so expensive because it runs a series of programs that the parents have to come to, and they have to bring all their kids in a certain age range. Then most of the cost here is the incentives to get the parents to run, to come. And I should tell you that I've inflated these costs, and I have to go back and check on this one. They may not have increased the parent incentives, so it may be a little bit cheaper than this. But the problem is there's reach. You've got a reach problem here. You couldn't put this into every kid in every school because not all the parents will come. So it becomes a supplement and complement perhaps in your schools with the largest problems to those school-based interventions that you can cause every kid to take. But it's not going to do as a substitute. The other thing I should mention is that this program makes the parents come, and many of these programs make the parents come and all the kids in a certain age range. But they only evaluate one kid. So the prevention and the benefit-cost ratios here are probably underestimated. There are also programs on the National Register of Effective Prevention Programs where there's so little return on investment. In some cases, they return less than they cost, that I think they really should be removed from that registry. Things like Project Toward No Drugs, STARS for Families, CASA Start Across Ages. As we move to environmental prevention starts with public support, and it starts by getting people to understand the risks, changing their expectations, changing their norms around the risks. That makes it possible to implement laws, to implement policies. It may be a state law. It may be the rules of the house, the rules of the workplace. And it also makes it possible to enforce the laws that we have. And so that's how the typology of environmental prevention works. And I think it's really important to think about that. In drunk driving, we've done very well with public support and norms. In sexual assault, we're really starting to work on that through CDC's Rape Prevention Education Program, but we're nowhere near there yet. It's a huge problem that we don't talk about, that we don't do anything about. The National Register of Effective Prevention Programs I was just asked about, that is on the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's website. Just search for NREPP, and they have a lot of programs listed there. They're largely substance abuse programs, but they're not entirely. So, environmental prevention with respect to alcohol. We've already mentioned raising alcohol taxes, reducing alcohol outlet density, restricting alcohol sales hours, TV alcohol advertising bans. We've mentioned the 21 minimum drinking age and doing things around servers. One of the constraints here is that as I look at the benefit-cost ratios here, the costs are, if I say, oh, we're going to reduce outlet density by 10%, I'm costing people not to be able to buy alcohol conveniently that they wanted to buy. I've taken account of that. I've assumed that the 50% profit that the alcohol industry makes on that alcohol, or in other words, the sales lost by the profits lost by the industry, are part of the costs of those interventions. And that limits this. The benefit-cost ratios here would be almost 10 times this if I didn't put those costs in, because there's very little cost to a law from government's perspective. There are also a lot of workplace programs out there, and increasingly those are oriented towards young workers. There are a series of programs that the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration has been developing for youth in the workplace, kids who are transitioning into work, many of them still teenagers, and learning that they can't abuse substances and be responsible workers. We've already mentioned that the evaluations often don't assess some impacts, and that's one of the things we need to think about as we think of program selection criteria. In selecting a program, we want to think about things like return on investment. And remember, I was telling you to subtract the cost from the benefits and see what the aggregate benefit is, because sometimes something with a lower benefit cost ratio gives you more total benefit because it prevents more of the problem. If you can afford it, you should do it. But we have to think about what we can afford, and we have to think about what the local problems are. If our biggest problem is marijuana, we make a different choice than if our biggest problem is alcohol. We have to think about what's appropriate for the target population. If the target population is an ethnic population, what's been shown to work in that ethnic group? That's important to consider. What's politically feasible? If you're looking at an educational program that includes some discussion of risky sex, and you're in a rural Catholic community, the school board might not stand for that. That's going to be a reason to not select that program. It's useful to look at the savings to government. The immediacy of the impacts is important. I can implement an education program overnight. I can often make a change to a roadway pretty quickly if I've got the money. But it may take me years to pass a law. I may never be able to pass it if it's a law like a motorcycle helmet law that interferes with the personal freedom of adults. I want to think about how interventions overlap. If I'm implementing five things that all address pieces of a problem, what pieces do they go at, and is there good overlap? And I want to remember those unevaluated spillover effects, those things that weren't in the evaluation that may make something more effective than they said it was. I wanted to briefly mention to you the 21 minimum drinking age, because it's been in the news a lot lately. The 21 minimum drinking age reduces the percentage of youth who drink and binge. It raises the age of initiation, which lowers the risk of alcoholism in adulthood. It reduces youth drunk driving deaths by 19%. It reduces alcohol-involved youth suicides by an estimated 27%. And for some unknown reason, it confuses college presidents. Another thing that's been in the news lately are state stores, retail alcohol monopolies. They reduce underage drinking if you've got a wine and spirits monopoly by about a third. They reduce spirits with a spirits monopoly by about 10%. They also reduce youth impaired driving deaths somewhat proportionally. And for some unknown reason, they confuse governors. Both Virginia and Washington State, the governors are trying to sell off their spirits monopolies. That will cause spirits consumption to rise by 21% by my estimate, overall consumption to rise by 6-7%. The state will lose $200 to $300 million a year in revenue net of taxes on added sales. Now, in Virginia, he's saying he's going to make up all but $50 million of that by imposing some added taxes on the system in terms of licensing. But the real price of these goes beyond even that $50 million or $200 million that they're going to give up. The real price is a crime wave. And each state, if they implement this, will pay about $50 million a year for added harm, with over 200 residents a year dying because of this intervention and this sell-off. And the industry has funded some conservative private sector groups to put out slides that ostensibly show that, quote, control states are states where you will not suffer harm, particularly more than in any other state. Those slides are bogus. A lot of those control states don't have state stores. They don't have retail monopolies. They just sell from the state as a wholesaler to the retailers, and they let the retailers sell to whoever they want to in the same way that retailers want to. We know that state stores don't sell to kids much more effectively than other stores. In fact, what I'd like to see us doing personally is saying, hey, half of Alka-Pops, those overly sweet drinks that no adult would drink, are consumed by underage drinkers. We should move them in the state stores where we've got state stores. So let's talk some about savings to states. And this is an example. 43 human exposure calls from rural areas prevent one hospital admission. So for about $1,800 worth of poison control center services, we're going to save over $10,000 in other medical costs. So does that mean the state will save money from poison control center services? Well, the first thing we have to realize is only about a quarter of the medical costs are paid by government. Half of that is paid by Medicare. So an eighth is paid by Medicaid. We're already under $1,800. And in most states, between 50 and 75% of the Medicaid cost is picked up by, could the moderator stop typing in another question? Because it distracts me every time you do it. I'm sorry. What we're finding is that Medicaid costs come up at about 50 to 75% paid by the federal government. So we're getting maybe $600, $800 in state government savings here out of something that's hugely effective and makes lots of sense. So it's not realistic to expect state government savings. I should also remark that if there is another question, for some reason it didn't come up on my screen, and the questions have stopped coming up on my screen. I don't know why. As we look, what is a state store? State stores are stores that sell alcohol, and they're the only place you can buy liquor, or they're the only place you can buy liquor and wine in the state. There are about 6 to 8 states where there's about 10 states still, that's the only way you buy spirits, for example. And in 2 of those states, their governors are trying hard to sell off those stores and make a one-time profit of about $450 million to get out of their budget crisis. Okay, so what I did was I looked at what would happen in terms of how much the state would need as a benefit cost ratio to break even on its investment. For property crime, it's actually about $1.60. A benefit cost ratio of about 1.6 for property crime, because the costs of property crime prevention are almost, the costs of property crime are extremely largely concentrated in adjudication and sanctioning. It's the courts, it's the criminal, it's the prisons, it's probation. To some extent, that's true of violence and drugs as well. An awful lot of the cost for violence and for drugs is out here in sanctioning, and to some extent, even for alcohol. So you'd need a return of about 7 to 1 to break even in violence or drugs, about 20 to 1 for alcohol. When you get something like smoking or motor vehicle crashes, it's closer to 80 to 100 to 1. Of course, as I mentioned, if it's a law that interferes with personal freedom, it's probably a lot lower benefit cost ratio because most of the costs are not government costs. But should we really expect the state to make money through our injury prevention efforts? I don't think so. The job of the state is to protect and enhance the welfare of its citizens. Like medical care, preventive health and safety efforts are designed to save lives and increase quality of life. And that means that the savings to citizens and employers count. When we go out to treat a heart attack, we don't treat a heart attack because we're going to save money. We treat a heart attack because somebody's going to be alive, because they're going to be able to still do things. We don't go operate on cancer and do radiation therapy from cancer because we'll save medical spending. It would be a lot cheaper to let that person die. But that's not what we're supposed to be doing if we're a government. We're supposed to be saving lives. We're supposed to be increasing quality of life. And there's no reason to hold prevention to a different standard. I'm not giving kids child seats so that we can save medical spending, even though if Medicaid gives kids child seats, they will save Medicaid spending. I'm giving kids child seats so that they won't walk with a limp for the rest of their life, so they won't have brain damage for the rest of their life. And my job as a government is to preserve the quality of life of my citizens and do it cheaply. And there's no reason we shouldn't hold prevention to that same standard that we hold medical care to. We look at the costs of injury and substance abuse to government. About 6% of the medical costs are going to be paid by the state. Income tax varies widely between states, but maybe 4% of the wage loss. There's welfare costs. In many states, there's lost sales taxes. For violence, there's victim assistance. There's police, fire, emergency medical services, road cleanup and repair, but those are very small costs. As I said, there's adjudication and sanctioning and child protective services. There are costs to the education system in terms of special education and truancy control and things like that, disruption when kids are violent. And if we target interventions to Medicaid recipients, then a quarter to a half of the Medicare savings go to the state. So again, that's a place where sometimes the state can get a good return, even though benefit cost ratio is lower. But it's important to remember that government only pays, say, 6% of the crash cost bill. Employers pay a lot more of it, and families pay most of it, because they're paying all the pain, suffering, lost quality of life. And they're paying through their insurance. The cost to employers are another way that government benefits, because government's a very large employer. Government pays, when an employee is injured, workers' comp costs, health insurance, sick leave, disability insurance, life insurance. If it's an on-the-job employee harming others, they've got a liability bill. They've got a supervisor who's got to investigate the incident. They've got distracted workers. People are talking about the water cooler, about Johnny's son got hurt instead of working. There's all sorts of work disruption. The supervisor may be juggling schedules or hiring somebody. And if it's working at substance abuse, there are employees who, because they're abusing drugs, are less productive. And it's worth realizing that of the $63 billion that crashes cost employers annually in fringe benefit costs and in liability costs, half of that results from non-work injury. Benefit-eligible employees and their benefit-eligible dependents are 80% of the fringe benefit costs of motor vehicle crashes to employers. And where do those $62 billion, and the reason for that's very simple. A lot more of our driving is done outside of work than while working. So that's when our crashes occur. If you pay my health insurance, if you pay my sick leave, that's when you're going to pay it. $62 billion a year. And where does that come from? It comes from profits. It comes from price increases. And that's why employers should be out there working for laws that increase highway safety, that increase all kinds of safety for their employees, why they should be out there educating their employees about safety. It's good business. This is a list of online resources. The first one here is the Children's Safety Network address, where you can find our return on investment fact sheets, the newly updated ones. You can also find their cost of child abuse and neglect by state. On our underage drinking fact sheets are on the web. Also on the web through the Children's Safety Network, though housed at the University of, at West Virginia University, are hospitalized injury costs by cause and age group and incidents in 38 states, so that you can look there and you can create figures for yourself specific to your state if your state has the hospital discharge data available on what the causes of injury are among kids in different age groups. We also have on that website impaired driving fact sheets by state. They're in the drop-down menu for each state. We have a report that's on the web on substance abuse prevention and all the substance abuse prevention benefit cost ratios with more detail on them than are in the fact sheets. And similarly, we have crime costs available by state. Those are available on request to the Children's Safety Network, and intake for those should go to Dexter Taylor on my staff at the PIER Children's Safety Network subsite. That's the Economics Resource Center, and I've listed his phone number here. His email address is also here. I've listed here for you a couple other references. Karen Wheeler's book, where most of the costs that I showed you came from, and also with more detail on the methods underlying that, a book on costs of injury for all ages. And then an article that gives you more detail on how the benefit cost ratios and cost per quality are calculated for those who want to see it. And again, has more detail, as the Karen Wheeler book does, on some of the subcategories of costs for the benefit cost ratios. In summary, injury is the leading child health risk. Prevention yields large savings for taxpayers. It's unrealistic to expect state government savings, but state government should be in the business of creating good health cheaply and preventing disability, not saving money for the state government. When we target to the Medicaid population, that increases state government's return and federal government return. Laws and enforcement often save the state money even if they have relatively low benefit cost ratios. As you present big numbers like the costs of injury, remember that people don't often understand big numbers. So use a yardstick, do performance comparisons, get your message across. Select costs that suit the audience. Remember that you can't spend some savings. And don't mislead your advocates and your partners and let them think that they can go out and say, oh, the cost of motor vehicle crashes is $62 billion. Think of what else we could do with that money. And actually, with the employer costs, that doesn't have that doesn't have quality of life loss in the numbers I just showed you there. But most of our costs do. Make sure that people don't say, oh, you could go spend all this money if what they're going to save is quality of life, if what they're going to save is they're going to prevent people from dying, and that will prevent a lifetime of earnings loss, and that earning loss will be spread over 40 years. Make sure your allies understand what's in your costs and how to state what they can and can't save. And finally, put a face and a story with the dollars. It's important to show dollars, but often what sticks in an educator's mind is the person who gets up there and said, my kid was injured, and this is what it cost my family, and this is the financial tragedy that it created for us. And sometimes that's better. The other thing is, when you're presenting quality of life, I always tell people that if you're in a state government and you're up testifying, you may get grilled about how you calculated quality of life. What? Somebody who's a survivor or who lost somebody to an injury, go present those costs. Because state legislators, when they're listening to somebody who suffered a tragedy, would never think to say, why do you think your husband was worth $4 million? Why do you think your kid was worth $5 million? They're not in a mode where it would even cross their mind ask that question. So handling costs with quality of life in is well presented by one of the advocates you're working with, often better than with your own government. We have some time for questions now, and I apologize for any that I missed on the chat. For some reason, my chat has stopped working. So let me turn it back to the moderator, I guess, and we'll open up the lines for questions.
Thank you so much, Ted, for the presentation. If you have any questions, would you please type them into your chat box? And I'm not sure if we're actually opening the lines back up or not. So to be sure that we get your question, please type it back in. One of the questions we have is Ed Maldonado would like us to go back one screen. So I guess that's right before the summary.
Right. Okay, I'm back there.
And if you can let us know what your question is, Ed, but so that everyone knows, this presentation will not only be on the Children's Safety Network webpage, which is www.childrensafetynetwork.org, no spaces, and that is a double S between children's and safety, but it will also be emailed to everyone who registered for today's webinar. Again, it takes up to 48 hours, I believe, to sync the audio and the PowerPoint presentation, and then you can download the slides only, the audio only, and Zoe will have to tell us if you get them together. You may have noticed our audio started slightly late, so you need to page in about 5 slides before clicking on your audio. We have another question.
I have a couple questions here. I can see them now, Monique. Ying Lu wants to know the reference for the benefit cost ratio for smoke alarms. The updated one that I showed you is in the new fact sheets, and it will be in a report that I expect to see released shortly by the Consumer Product Safety Commission that has in it some other benefit cost ratios around burn-related interventions as well. An older version of that actually appears in an article in Injury Prevention by myself and David Levy that's a primer on how to do cost-benefit analysis injury prevention, published in 1997. That's where we first published a benefit cost analysis of smoke alarms. There's also a benefit cost analysis of smoke alarms, a separate one that the Centers for Disease Control has published. I personally recommend ours for general use, though theirs is useful if you're looking at a smoke alarm installation program. They looked at the Oklahoma program. Brandy Jensen indicated she's interested in the PowerPoint. Says Monique said the PowerPoint will be put up on the web. I'm going to correct that one thing where I typed the number in wrong first. The National Register of Effective Prevention Programs, just search for NREPP SAMHSA, and you should get right into it. But I want to emphasize that that's a registry of effective substance abuse prevention programs. The thing that we have that's somewhat comparable to that for injury are the Cochrane Collaborative searches that Fred Rivera's group at the University of Washington have done. And you can access those, I believe, on the web as well. There are also additional searches on the Cochrane Collaborative generally on a lot of other injury interventions, but I find that they seem to want to charge me for a lot of those, and I haven't found a way to get them for free, other than through interlibrary loan myself. Do we have other questions?
All right, while we give people a few seconds to type in any additional questions, I just want to make sure that everyone knows, if you think of questions after the session, you can send them to Zoe Baptista, and her email address, you saw it in your registration, but it's zbaptista@edc.org, and we will put her email address where those phone numbers are, just so you can copy that down and get the correct spelling of it. But that is it's there right there from Zoe. Thank you, Zoe. If you think of any questions after the fact, that is the best way to reach anyone within the Children's Safety Network whoever appears on any of our webinars, and Zoe will make sure the question is distributed to the proper person. And I'm going to turn it over to Ted. Can you still see the questions? A few more have popped up.
No, I don't. Oh, wait. Okay.
From Karma?
Yeah, okay, from Karma. Do you know of any sources for program effectiveness for injury programs other than alcohol and drug use ones? That's what I said, is look on Fred Rivera's website at the University of Wisconsin Injury Prevention, University of Washington Injury Prevention Center. Fred has done a lot of Cochrane reviews on unintentional injury prevention for children, and that's where to find them. The other place to look on violence is there are two review reports from just done by the World Health Organization in the EU that are available on the web. And also there's at the Department of Education, there's a lot of violence prevention effectiveness information. And there's a report on the Washington State Institute for Public Policy website that gives you a lot of effectiveness information on youth violence interventions, particularly ones for youth who are already violent offenders, though. But unintentional injuries, the main source is going to be Fred Rivera's website and his Cochrane summaries that he has up there for free.
Any additional questions? Also, please note in your chat box that Zoe has posted the website for the Children's Safety Network. And we have a question from Paul.
Cost analysis. Carl Roston wants to know what the best way is to get a cost analysis done for his state of the costs of suicide. I think the first thing that I would say is the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, which is housed at EDC, already has up on the web the cost of hospital-admitted suicide and the cost of suicide fatalities for every state. So that would be the quick and easy way to start with that. That doesn't cover the ones treated in the ED and released, but that captures everything above the level of hospital admitted. And if you have further questions about that, if you email CSN and perhaps Dexter Taylor, whose address I gave you before, he could field that and get us to the proper person. Actually, a lot of the my staff and Monique, who's just been speaking, are the ones who are handling producing a lot of those suicide costs, so they have the ability to answer the questions about them.
And Zoe has also added the website for the Suicide Prevention Resource Center in your chat box. A question.
We have another question. What about the cost of traumatic brain injury? I have them nationally. We've done costs of traumatic brain injury nationally. We have not done breakouts of those costs by state. It's an interesting idea. And as I think about it, we could do it for the 38 states where we have hospital discharge data. I'm trying to remember, Monique, do you remember whether our state costs that we have up on the web show costs for the hospital admissions by diagnosis group, or do they only have them for cause group?
Only for cause group.
Right. Okay. National costs of traumatic brain injury you can get in two places. I have a chapter in a recent textbook called Neurotrauma and Critical Care of the Brain. The editors of the textbook are Jack Jallo, J-A-L-L-O, and Christopher Loftus, L-O-F-T-U-S. It's published by Theme, and that has cost traumatic brain injury in nationally. And there's a second textbook coming out on traumatic brain injury that will also have a cost a chapter in it that covers some of the costs. You'll also find some of the costs covered for traumatic brain injury in the CDC book, The Incidence and Economic Burden of Injuries in the United States, that was published by Oxford University Press. The one downside of those costs is that they don't include the quality of life loss in the CDC book. The book for the TBI, somebody wants me to repeat it. It's called Neurotrauma and Critical Care of the Brain. The publisher is Theme, T-H-I-E-M-E. And the authors are Jack Jallo, J-A-L-L-O, and Christopher Loftus. I can also make sure that our EDC technical assistance providers have that article available to them so that their librarians can answer questions about it if people have questions about it in terms of needing specific numbers from it.
Are there any other questions?
We just got another one. How can we get resources to be able to do our own cost analysis for our own specific prevention programs? If you start out by looking at that 1997 article on injury prevention by Miller and Levy, it gives you sort of a primer on how to do a benefit cost analysis of a program. The key thing that you need is to have good estimates of what the effects of your program are on numbers of injuries and numbers of deaths. And if you've got that, generally you can find in the literature the costs for injuries from a specific cause or for specific diagnoses and use those to construct a benefit-cost ratio. We published an article, I believe, in Pediatrics or else in Archives of Child and Adolescent Medicine, but I think it's one of the two, where we did a benefit-cost ratio of booster seats. I think it's Pediatrics. And that article would also give you a good example of how we took somebody else's published effectiveness estimates for booster seats and converted them into a benefit cost analysis. Another example like that, though it's very old, but it's still a good example, is Miller and Galbraith in Pediatrics back in the 90s on the evaluation of the TIP program, the injury prevention program injury prevention counseling by pediatricians. Something like cost benefit of injury prevention counseling for pediatricians, where we constructed by knowing how many childhood injuries were prevented and knowing what the cost of a childhood injury was and doing some stopwatch timing to see how long the counseling took, we were able to do a benefit cost analysis of that program. The quality of life costs for TBI survivors are in that textbook that I gave you. Programs to prevent all-terrain vehicle injuries. In the fact sheets, there is a benefit cost ratio for all-terrain vehicle helmets. That benefit cost ratio came from the Consumer Product Safety Commission's information, and that appears in the fact sheets. The other thing I should remark, Kim Lombard, is that you should also feel free to contact Dexter Taylor for technical assistance in doing your own analysis for a specific program. Often we can help you with that, provided it's a childhood injury program.
All righty. Do we have any other questions? I know it takes you a minute to type them in. We're going to take one more run through to see if anyone types them in, but while we do that, I want to join Jennifer Abbott's sentiments, and that this was an excellent presentation, and thank you so much, Ted, for sharing with us. I don't see any additional questions at this time. Do our technical staff have any final words to say?
No, I think we're all set.
We'd like to thank everyone for attending, and make sure you contact CSN if you should have any additional questions.
Yes, the Children's Safety Network provides free technical assistance to states in terms of injury prevention. We also do training and work with you in other areas to build your program in case we have anybody here who's not familiar with the Children's Safety Network. Please scroll through your chat bar. Be sure to pick up our web address, www.childrensafetynetwork.org. And please visit our website often and look for upcoming webinars that we'll be having on a variety of different injury subjects in the weeks and months to come. At this time, I want to check in with our speaker, Dr. Ted Miller, to see if he has any final words before we sign off.
Only go out there, use these numbers, and make our world safer for our kids. Thank you.
Well, Marie Reed has sent in a comment. Oh, just thanking us for the great information. You are so welcome, Marie, and we look forward to providing you with more resources in the future. Everyone, have a wonderful afternoon, and thank you for joining us.
I think, Monique, that Marie Reed has one other question. Is anyone looking at programs to prevent all-terrain vehicle injuries?
We already answered it.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.